Okay, I think we can start 11:15. Okay, it's always a pleasure to welcome Yoetzet Halacha Atara Kelman, who is teaches at Ramaz. Her third teaching in Ramaz is the Yoetzet Halacha for Tiferet Beth David Jerusalem in Montreal. Graduate of the GPATS program at Stern, and a special pleasure to welcome her on Som Gedalia Vakasha Atara.
Thank you, Danny. Thank you, everyone, for having me. And I'm really excited. I think I'm the only slot today that's really going to be focusing on the book of Yonah, which I'm really excited about. But I'm also really happy that I was here for part of Dr. Simkovich's, because we're going to be building up on that theme of chesed, really, as something that we're asking for going into Yom Kippur, perhaps more than din, than judgment, which is how we maybe typically associate the holiday of Yom Kippur. Now, if you've ever maybe looked at art that depicts scenes from the book of Yonah, you'll probably notice that all the art is very, very fantastical. And the whole story of Yonah is this very, very small book. It is four chapters, one of the books of Tryasar, one of the minor prophets at the end of the section of prophets in Tanakh. And everything in the whole book seems very exaggerated. It all seems really crazy. If you look just even in the first chapter, the word gadol, the word that means big, appears six times. And you read through the book and everything is so fantastic and so exaggerated. So much so that there was actually a view quoted in the early Middle Ages that most of the book of Yonah was actually a dream. And there are those who maintain that actually from when Yonah goes onto the boat, through the whole conversation with the sailors, getting the storm, getting thrown overboard, swallowed by a fish, praying inside the fish, getting spat out, all of that happened actually in a dream. Now, I think, you know, the typical understanding is not that way, but almost like regardless of whether it happened or it didn't happen, this really fantastic, exaggerated, over-the-top book is really, I think, talking about a question that confronts all of us almost on a daily basis. In any relationship with or having with another person or with God, and that is the question of justice versus kindness. And that's certainly questions that parents and children face with each other. As a teacher, it's a question I face a lot. But anytime we are dealing with a human encounter and someone wronged us or didn't, or we're asking for something that we deserve or we don't deserve, we are confronted with the question of, do we make arguments based on what we deserve, or do we make arguments kind of extrajudicially? And when we are the ones granting gifts to people, or when we are the ones who are maybe punishing people, are we doing that according to the letter of the law? And are we doing that in a sense of strict justice and order? Or are we maybe doing that in ways of kindness? And which of those do we even want? How do we want the world to run? And I think that question of, if you got to choose, and luckily we don't need to choose one or the other, and we can blend the two, but if we had to choose between justice and kindness, it's not so obvious which one I think we would choose, which one we think would be better for the world to run with. So I want us to start with a midrash that suggests to us that the whole existence of the world depended on this question. So let me pull up the sources. Can I get a thumbs up? Okay, amazing. Thank you. So here's a midrash from Bereishit Rabbah. And it fills us in on a conversation that God was having when God decided to create human beings. And so we get the words of Rabbi Simon, Amar Rabbi Simon, B'sha'ah sheba kadosh baruch hu livrod et adam harishon, nasu malachei hasharei kitim kitim. So the Midrash orients us on the sixth day of creation. So what's notable, first of all, about that is a lot of the world has been created already. The only thing left to be created is Adam HaRishon, the first human being. And all of a sudden, the angels who presumably were, around, excited, encouraging God during the rest of creation, divide up into teams. And this is what they say. So Nasim al-Khashar, Kitim, Kitim, Chavurot, they break off into factions, into groups. Mehem al Yibara, Mehem Yibara, Hadehu Dechtiv, Chesed Nifkashu. So some of them were going to God and saying, God, don't create man. Some of them are saying, God, you should create Adam HaRishon. And the Midrash connects this to Pasuk in Tehillim that talks about these different attributes. Chesed ve'emet, tzedek and shalom, kindness and truth and righteousness and peace all kind of met each other, because we're now going to see they're going to divide up into two teams. Chesed omer yibara, shehu gomel chasadim. Okay, so the first group of angels on our side is Chesed. And Chesed said people should be created. And this is like a very, very nice, I guess, optimistic view of human beings. Shehu gomel chasadim, because people do a lot of Chesed. Ve'emet omer al yibareh shekulo shgarim. Comes along truth and says, don't create human beings because human beings are full of lies. Tzedek omer yibareh shehu aseh tzedakot. Righteousness says create humans because humans do righteousness. Shalom omer al yibareh duchulei ktata. But peace says don't create people because people don't have a lot of peace. They're full of conflict. Okay, so you can almost imagine, right? We're halfway through the sixth day of creation. There's water, there's trees, there's fish, there's birds. God's getting ready to make people, and all of a sudden this fight breaks out in Shemayim, and you have these teams of angels, create people, don't create people, back and forth arguing, what does God do? Okay? Ma'asa HaKadosh Baruch Hu, I'm in the third paragraph here. Natal emet v'hashlichol la'aretz. God lifts up truth and throws emet down to the ground. Hadehu dechtiv v'tishlach emet artza. Okay, and again, the Midrash keeps quoting these psukim, that it's saying is a reference to this. So it quotes here a pasuk from Daniel, where God cast truth earthward. Amru malachei hasharei livnei HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ribon haolamim, ma atah mevazeh tachsis al tachsiyah shelcha, ta'ala emet min haaretz. And all of a sudden, all the angels who until this point were bickering and arguing, they're horrified. They don't understand what God just did, because they turned to the God and they said, Master of the universe, how are you demeaning your very seal? Okay, which is the Malachim are really taken aback by this because God is known as a God of Emet. And if God is a God of Emet, if God is a God of truth, how could God take Emet and throw it on the ground? And based on that, they quote this pasuk, that Emet will rise back up from the earth. Truth will spring from the earth. Okay, so what we have here is God, picks a side in this argument and clearly goes for the side that says we should create human beings. But in order to do that, God's going to need to put truth aside. Now, God does not destroy truth. And truth still has a footing, right? It's still going to come back up from the ground, but it gets deprioritized, I guess. And now we have like this little interjection in the Midrash, where the Midrash says that when the Torah describes how God looked at what God created, and it was tov me'od, it was very good, which is language that's used on the sixth day of creation. For the first 5 days, the Torah says God saw what he created and it was tov. And on the sixth day, God saw what he created and it was tov me'od. So the Midrash does a play on words. And it says, if you rearrange the letters of the word me'od, that it was very good, you get the word Adam, which is the word for the human being. And so based on that, the Midrash says man is really good. Okay, now we have almost like this interjection kind of to support God's decision, right? God decides to create man. Now we get the voice of Rabbi Chanina Bar Idi, who are saying man is me'od. Man is what is described as tov me'od, as a thing that's extra good. And now we go back to what was happening during this argument. The last five lines here. Rav Huna Rabba Shel Tziporen Amar. Ad shemalachai hasharei medayinin elu im elu mitaskin elu im elu bra'o hakadosh baruch hu. Amar lahem ma atem medayinim kvar naase adam. Okay, and this is like a really funny ending to the Midrash. Rav Huna tells us that while the angels are all still arguing with each other and they're debating back and forth, God turns to them and says, why are you still, you know, arguing about this? I already created man, right? And it's almost, I don't know, you laugh a little bit, right? About the, you know, all the people around God who are wasting time not getting anything done. God says in the time that it takes you to argue about what our, you know, policy decisions should be, I'm just going to go ahead and do it. Okay, now what I want to argue is that this question of the Midrash of should man be created? And if man is going to be created, do we need to push aside Emmet? Is what I think the question of the book is Yonah as well. And it's the argument that Yonah and God have throughout the book. Now, to go back just to introduce the book of Yonah for a minute, the biggest question when you read the book of Yonah, I think, is why is Yonah running away, right? What is he thinking? God approaches Yonah, asks him to do something, and Yonah, we don't even get a response in the psukim. He doesn't say anything back to God. He just gets up, and he was supposed to go east, and he gets on a boat and instead tries to go west. Now, to be fair, I think Yonah has like a particularly maybe bad reputation. He's not the first time that a prophet gets instruction from God and is not enthusiastic about it and even challenges God, right? And now if we start, I guess, with the first instance, if we go back to Avraham, I guess there's maybe three stories where Avram gets a specific command from God, or there's more, but to do something. Let's say the first is Lach Lecha. God comes to Avram. They've never had a conversation before, as far as we know. Get up, go to the place where I'm going to show you. And in a bold act of obedience, Avram just also does not respond, gets up and goes. What we read on Rosh Hashanah, the story of the Akedat Yitzchak, of the binding of Yitzchak, they are almost like scarier. Avram also doesn't respond to God. He wakes up and he goes. We do have a third instance though, where Avram is willing to challenge God. And that's when God doesn't even command him anything, but tells him of his plans to destroy Sodom. And all of a sudden we see that Avram is able to carry on this argument and this conversation with God. And Avram starts actually negotiating with God. And ultimately, though, Avram loses, right? And God says, no, sorry, your arguments don't stand, and I'm going to go ahead and destroy Sodom. And that's, of course, what ends up happening, right? If you look at Moshe, our next greatest leader, when God appoints Moshe at the burning bush to ask him to go to Egypt and bring the Jewish people out of Egypt, Moshe not only says no, but he has five times he and God go back and forth where he tries to refuse his mission. And he says, don't send me. I'm not qualified. Send somebody else. I won't do a good job. And back and forth, back and forth. Moshe also, God asks him to do something. And we see the automatic response when God asks people to do something, maybe surprisingly, isn't always, you know, okay, God, I'm on it. But there was pushback. And again, in the case of Moshe, though, of course, God wins out. If we take a third example from later, the Navi Yirmiyahu, Jeremiah, has in the opening chapters of the book of Yirmiyahu, he has, again, this appointment by God to become prophet. And it uses a lot of the same language, actually, that is similar to when God appoints Moshe. And Yirmiyahu is also not interested in his mission. And for good reason, right? Yirmiyahu is going to be the prophet of destruction and terrible things. He ends up having a terrible life where the Jews don't want to hear what he has to say and try to kill him and throw him in jail. But of course, right at the end, God says, I want you to be my prophet. Yirmiyahu says, I don't want to, I'm not qualified. And God says, you know, I'm with you, you're doing it. And then when you get to Yonah, I think what's so surprising it's you don't really have the back and forth. It's not that God appears to Yonah, says, get up, go to Nineveh and give them the message that I'm asking you to do. And Jonah says, hey, God, I don't want to, or hey, God, I think that's a bad idea. Jonah just gets up and runs away. And so the question, at least in the opening of the book, is why is Jonah running away? Now we'll quickly go through some of the common approaches, but then for the bulk of the rest of the year, what I want to focus on is really the reason that Jonah gives in his own words. Because Jonah himself, much later in the book, actually answers this question for us, and that's what I want us to give most of our attention to. But before that, we could look at almost like a spectrum in the commentaries that are more or less sympathetic to Jonah. So one of the more sympathetic approaches to Jonah's seeming disobedience of God situates us in the historical context of when Jonah's prophesying and who the people of Nineveh is are. And when you realize that Jonah's a prophet in the kingdom of Israel, the northern kingdom, kind of getting towards the end of the period of the first temple of the first Beit HaMikdash, and Nineveh is a big city in Ashur, in Assyria, that's the enemy of the Jewish people of the northern kingdom. We know that Ashur is going to be the one that is going to come and exile and destroy the northern kingdom, and kick out the ten tribes. So, and Jonah then gets this command from God to go to the people of Nineveh to rescue them and to say, hi guys, you're gonna be destroyed unless you do something about it. I'm coming to tell you that now's your last chance. Do better and you'll be saved. And Jonah says, I'm not really interested in helping our enemy. And Jonah decides almost to take one for the team. And he says, you know what, God, even if I'm going to die instead of doing this mission, I'd rather be thrown overboard. I'd rather lose everything than go and help the people of Nineveh survive and ultimately bring about the destruction of the northern kingdom of Israel. Right? So that's like a very sympathetic view of Jonah that says it's true. Jonah's disobeying God. Jonah has a fundamental disagreement with God, which is perhaps a little bit surprising. But ultimately, what Jonah's doing is for the interests of the Jewish people and really to protect the Jewish people. There are actually fun commentaries who just say Jonah was like old and weak and frail, and he wasn't interested in this mission. He thought God was going to do what God's going to do anyway. He doesn't really need me. Why are you making me schlep all the way over there? If you're going to save them anyway, just save them without making me get up and go. Which is, I don't know what that makes us think about Jonah. I guess it's like a more practical reason for his disobedience. And there's another approach that a lot of the commentaries cite, which is m more, which is a view that thinks Jonah was concerned about his reputation. And Jonah already, the Midrash tells us, had a reputation as a false prophet because this was not his first time prophesizing that something bad would happen. He would say, Jerusalem's going to be destroyed or Nineveh is going to be destroyed. And then lo and behold, destruction did not happen. God had mercy and saved the city. And people are like, oh, Jonah, you said you were the voice of God. What you said would happen didn't happen. And they actually doubted Jonah. And Jonah was saying to God, I'm not interested in another one of those scenarios. I don't want to go tell everyone they're going to be destroyed, they not be destroyed. And my whole reputation as a prophet is going to be tarnished. Jonah wasn't interested in that. So those are like three of some of the most common approaches to understanding why Jonah decides to run away when God asks him to do something. But I want us now to look at Jonah's own words. So here we go. This is what Jonah actually says in the fourth chapter. Okay, now this is after Jonah finally does, fulfill his mission. After he runs away, right, God comes to him again and in almost the exact same language, just like God asked him the first time to go to Nineveh, he asks him a second time. And this time Jonah gets up, he goes to Nineveh, he says, guys, do tshuva, you're going to be destroyed. And in a very unusual turn of events, this is like almost the only example in Tanakh where a prophet comes to a group of people doing the wrong thing, says, do tshuva, and then the next pasuk, they're doing tshuva. Okay. And then Jonah sits outside the city And he turns to God, and this is what he says. Vayitpalal al Hashem. Yonah prays to God. Vayomer ana Hashem. Halo zed zvari al hayoti al admati. Al kin kadamti livroch tarshisha. Ki adzati ki ata el chanun verachum erech apayim verav chesed binichem al hara'a. Please, Hashem, is this not what I said while I was still on my land? Therefore, I fled before unto Tarshish, for I knew that you are a gracious and compassionate God, slow to anger, abundant in kindness, and you would relent of the evil. So according to Yonah, the reason why Yonah fled and tried not to come to Nineveh and instead ran away to Tarshish is because he knows that God is merciful. Right now, what is notable is Yonah here is quoting from the 13 attributes of God, from the Yod Gimel Midot, but he quotes selectively from that list. Now, if you notice which of the ones he quotes and which ones he doesn't quote, you'll notice he quotes compassion, slow to anger, abundant in kindness, that God will relent for the evil. What's notably missing is Emet. And what Yonah seems to be accusing God of is saying that, God, you are too merciful, you are too kind, you are too willing to forgive people and not to punish them. Where is your emet? I know that you don't practice your emet. I know that you only practice your rachamim and your chanun and your erech apayim. And that's why I ran away. I ran away because you're not really a God of truth. And that seems to be Yonah's accusation of against God. Now, if you think about it, right, what's Yonah's name? Okay, so we have very little information about Yonah's biography. But in the beginning of the parak, we're introduced to his name and his father's name, and he's Yonah ben Amittai. Right now, the word Amittai seems to come from the same word Emet. Right, Yonah is the son of truth. He's angry at God because he doesn't see God acting according to his characteristic of truth. And so he was willing to run away, to risk his life, to disobey God, because he wanted God to deal with the people of Nineveh with truth and not with rachamim and not with compassion or mercy or kindness. And if we look at the Abarbanel, we'll see he says this very clearly. And he says it really in two parts. There's one part that's Yonah wanted God to act with them with justice and with emet. There's a second part of why Yonah didn't want to help them, which is what we referred to before about Ashur actually being our enemy and a threat to the security of the northern kingdom. But here's what the Abarbanel writes. And he's trying to explain why was Yonah so angry. After Yonah goes to Nineveh and tells them to do tshuva, they do tshuva in a moment. And then Yonah's very, very upset. And the Abarbanel's trying to understand that. So he explains, okay, because of this, Yonah becomes very, very angry and upset. Okay, he had this illness of sadness in his heart. He wanted to die. Why? Okay, here is the argument Yonah is making according to the Abarbanel. Yonah thought that God would not forgive the people of Nineveh unless they did a complete tshuva, unless they totally repented, both in the areas, theological areas, they stopped doing avodah zarah and turned towards God, and in ethical, social areas. And what Yonah saw is that they did tshuva in the social ethical arena, but they did not do any sort of theological type of tshuva. They did not reject the avodah zarah in favor of God. And yet, despite that, God was willing to forgive them. And Yonah says, I don't understand, right? And the Abarbanel here assumes avodah zarah is worse And they did not stop doing Avodah Zarah. And so how could it be that God would still extrajudicially say, even though these people aren't really deserving of forgiveness, even though these people should still be punished because they're still doing a very severe sin, I am going to have mercy and kindness and compassion and be slow to anger to protect the people of Nineveh. And the Abarbanel goes on to explain, not only was he upset that God is, being slow to anger, but it's for what end? And if you look over here, where my mouse is, Yishmeren ke'ishon eino, right? God is protecting them like his eye. Kedesh yushevet apo uklize amolina Yisrael. God wants to protect the people of Nineveh because God wants to use the people of Nineveh to be the tool for God to take out his anger on the Jewish people. V'hitzlonen hanavi. And so the prophet is complaining, Bilibo mehashem, lama haya kavanatola hashchit et Yisrael al ha'avodah zarah shehayu odim ula'ansheinin ve'alvar al pish'am. Right? Yonah is almost accusing God of hypocrisy. And he's saying, I don't understand, God. Why are you intending to destroy the Jewish people because they're doing avodah zarah? And yet, when the people of Nineveh are still doing Avodah Zarah, you are okay to forgive it and to, use all your attributes of mercy and kindness and compassion. And this, says the Abarbanel, is the reason why he was so angry. And so, if we look at Yonah's word and we look at what the Abarbanel is saying, what the Yonah's argument to God is, God, I want you to act with emet, or at least I want you to be consistent when you're not acting with emet. But what Yonah is saying is it's not fair, right? If you can't forgive people if they have not done a complete tshuva. I came to Nineveh and I said, you will be destroyed if you don't do tshuva. They did a little bit of tshuva, but they didn't do enough of tshuva, and Yonah's upset that God is overriding the emet with his kindness, and God is electing to save the people of Nineveh, even though their tshuva was not complete. Now I want to pause for a second and zoom out from Yonah and look at what I really think is a remarkable Rashi. Now this Rashi sort of addresses the opposite direction. Not when we're being judged for punishments are we, demanding emet, or are we asking for kindness and for compassion? But what about when we're asking for good things? And when we want a gift, or we want to, cash in on our good behavior, do we ask God to give us kindness, because we deserve it, because of this idea of emet, of truth? It's what's right, it's what's, magia lanu, it's what we deserve. Even when we're asking for goodness, and even when we really deserve it, are we also asking God out of the sense of the other attributes of God, the rachamim and the erech apayim, and that kind of side of God? And Rashi, this the Rashi that we're going to look at now comes from the beginning of the book of Dvarim. And it's part of the tragedy, one of, I think, the biggest tragedies in the whole Torah. Is Moshe not getting to go into the land of Israel? And we're reading now in Shul the end of the book of Dvarim. And it's heartbreaking in a lot of ways. Moshe really wanted only one thing, and that was to go into the land of Israel. And Moshe was told by God he cannot go into the land of Israel. And Moshe, again, here kind of argues with God or prays for God to change his mind and to let Moshe enter into the land of Israel that he wants to enter so badly. And so here, this is the beginning of Parshat Va'etchanan, where God turned to, when Moshe turned to God and asks again to go into the land of Israel. And this is what he says, Va'etchanan. Okay, I pled with God. Ein chinun b'chol makom ela lashon matnat chinam. So Rashi says, anytime you see this shoresh of chet non non chinun, that is referring to a matanat chinam. a free gift, a gift that is not necessarily deserved. Af al pi, and Rashi goes from this grammar point to a moral ethical point. Af al pi sheyesh lahem latzadikim litzlop b'maaseihem hatovim, ein mevakshim me'et hamakom ela matnas chinam. Even though the righteous have merits of their good deeds on which they can ask things for God, they should not ask anything for God in any way other than asking it as a matana chinam. They should only ask things for God as a free, undeserved gift. The fisha amarler, okay, fine, right? And then he's mirroring God's own language that God used. And what Rashi is kind of telling us is we don't, the attribute of emet, maybe of magia, of deserved, of what's just and what's right, that's not the language we use even for good things. And even for things that we want, even when it's you're really a tzaddik, when you're Moshe Rabbeinu, and you have a life of commitment to the Jewish people, even then, when you're asking God for something, you're not asking it from emet and from justice and from I deserve it, says Rashi. You're asking it out of a sense of it is a matana chinam. Anything that I get from you, God, is a matana chinam. I don't have it because I deserve it. And we see a similar idea about tshuva that comes up in the Talmud Yerushalmi in Makot. Now, the whole tractate of Makot is a tractate that, is primarily about justice more than forgiveness, maybe. Makot is a tractate that talks about the punishments people would get. It starts by, which the court was had the jurisdiction to give people lashes when they violated a Torah command. The second chapter of Makot actually focuses on the accidental murder and the case of Iir Miklat. And it's in this context of kind of a pursuit of justice that the Yerushalmi quotes this Agadah. And it describes how they ask different attributes. What punishment should people get when they sin? And here we'll read it together. Sha'alu l'chokhmah, they ask wisdom. Chotem mahu onsho, what is the punishment for a sinner? Ra lahem, chata'im tirdof ra'ah. So wisdom responded, evil should pursue the wicked. So then they turn to Nivuah, they turn to the prophets. Sha'alu l'Nivuah, they turn to prophecy. Chotem mahu onsho, what is the punishment for a sinner? Amra lahem, hanefesh ha'chotat hi. So prophecy responds, a sinner should be put to death. Now, again, normally, right, chokhmah and nevuah, wisdom and prophecy are good things, right? The voices of wisdom and the voices of prophecy are voices that, for good reasons, we usually want to emulate. And here they're telling us wickedness has to be dealt with a sense of justice and severity. And if people do the wrong things, they have to face the appropriate consequences because that's actually how you promote justice and kindness and have a secure society. But then they turn to God. Sha'alu l'kodesh brichu. They then turn and they ask God, Chotem mahu onsho, what is the punishment for a sinner? Amar lahem, this is how God responds. Ya'aseh tshuva v'yit kaper lo. God says, let them do tshuva and let them achieve atonement. And so God is kind of saying, I'm not really interested in punishing anyone. I'm not interested in doing what's right, what they deserve. I'm not interested in pulling the emet out. And even when the Navi and the Chochmah are saying someone did something wrong and they should face consequences, God is saying, I want to give tshuva. And if you look at the commentary here on the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Pnei Yehoshua invokes these words, that God is acting lifnim mishurat hadin, beyond the letter of the law. And ultimately, God is saying tshuva is not necessarily what is just, but tshuva is still what's right. And tshuva is what I want sinners to do, even if that is not the deen. And chokhmah, wisdom might want deen, and nevuah, the prophets might want to go by justice, but God is saying, I'm not going just by deen. I am going by the path of tshuva, the path of rachamim and of mercy. And if you think, I'll summarize what we've done so far, then I want to quote one more midrash. What we did so far is we talked a little bit, just giving context for the book of Yonah, And we said that really the question of Yonah is a question of justice versus compassion. And while we looked at different approaches to why Yonah ran away, and we talked about the fact that Yonah's not the first prophet to kind of challenge the directives that he gets from God, Yonah is unique in the fact that he doesn't engage in conversation with God, he just leaves. And we have more sympathetic approaches or not. But ultimately, what Yonah says to God, in his words and in the words of the Abarbanel, is that he doesn't understand why God is being generous with the people of Nineveh when the people of Nineveh don't seem to deserve that generosity, and when that generosity is actually going to be used to hurt the Jewish people. And so we talked about how God maybe doesn't operate just by what's emet. And Yonah, who is Ben Amittai, the son of truth, had a really hard time with that. But God is saying, I act with rachamim. And Rashi tells us that's true across the board, not just when we're talking about punishments, but also when we're talking about reward. We ask for reward not because of emet, but because of rachamim. And that in general, the gift of tshuva, the idea that we can do tshuva, is itself, perhaps, the Talmud Yerushalmi tells us, that itself is not the din. That is not what should be allowed according to a sense of justice and what's right and what's deserved. That's only allowed because God tells us, do tshuva, I will allow you to do something that's lifnim mishurat hadin. And there's actually one other midrash now that I think is very relevant. And Rabbi Avahu teaches that tshuva is so great that it was created, it precedes the creation of the world. And what Rabbi Avahu is teaching with that midrash is the idea that in order for us to exist, in order for us to survive, the world to exist, human beings to be created, we need tshuva. And I think that kind of complements the opening midrash that we started with, of God had to throw emet down to the ground. Because if we only operated on a world of emet, we would not have tshuva. And if we didn't have tshuva, we would really, struggle. And while we the Navi Yonah might be happy to have strict justice, ultimately that would be a really, really dangerous and hard way to be. And I think ultimately, when we're the ones asking for tshuva, I think it's really easy to be on God's side of this argument, not the Yonah side, and say, of course, God, behave with us with rachamim. Be slow to anger, be kind to us, even if we don't deserve it. Give us tshuva. Let us do tshuva, which we don't deserve, but is a gift of kindness. But the flip side of that is sometimes we're the ones who need to be granting the forgiveness. And that, I think, is the time where it's much easier to feel like we want to do justice. And that, for the world to be good and to teach a lesson and to make sure it doesn't happen again, we need to be severe and strict. And maybe what the book of Jonah is coming to tell us is ultimately Jonah doesn't win. Ultimately, God gets the last word. And just as God grants the gift of tshuva, so too we should also grant the gift of tshuva to others. So thank you so much. Wishing you a Gemar Chatima Tova. And if anyone has any questions, I'm happy to take them.
All right, anybody? Okay, yeah, Vakasha. Ershan, go ahead.
I love what you said about Emmet. Yonah ben Amittai was is the his problem was that he focused on Emmet. It occurred to me that Tzedek Tzirdof can be interpreted as reinterpret. Don't just take tzedek as a single meaning, it has a double meaning.
Right.
Tzedek tzedek.
Right. Tzedek is itself a funny word because, on the one hand, it means like what's right and what's just. On the other hand, it's also the word for tzedakah, which is maybe, going beyond what you would say is just. But thank you.
Atar, you weren't here, I don't think, for Adam Mintzes, Rabbi Mintzes, but he quoted the Gemara, that God davens every day. So I was thinking of it, which at the end of one of his tefillot is I should act lifnim mishurat hadin, which was what exactly the
Okay.
The Pnei Moshe says there on the Yerushalmi that that's what it's all about. God praying for the Zvim Shurdin is praying to allow himself to do tshuva because it's against his Midah Bemet. Perhaps that ties into what he, God's also struggling with the issue is what I, perhaps.
Yeah, but, thank you.
Okay, anybody else? Yes, Asher.
Historical footnote for what it's worth. In the end, Nineveh is indeed destroyed, razed to the ground by a coalition of Chaldeans, Medes, and Persians. And out of that coalition arises Nebuchadnezzar, who is the one who comes and eventually destroys the Beit HaMikdash.
Right, that's interesting. Right, maybe you can even view it just, it was postponed, which maybe if Yonah knew that, he would have been a little bit happier. But thank you for sharing.
Okay, we will take now a 15-minute break, even though I don't know if it's a coffee break exactly, but if you're in Australia, it's a coffee break. But we'll please resume. We'll have Shoshana Schechter talking about the paradox of tshuva. I don't know exactly what she's going to be saying, but and then Yitzi Blau from Israel will be talking about tshuva and the thought of Rav Yitzchak Kuttner, the great Rosh Yeshiva of Chaim Berlin, and then Nadi Helfko will be talking about tshuva and the thought of tshuva Rashanim Kibbutz and the thought of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. So they just go and stretch a little bit, and we'll see you all back, please God.
In Israel, it's a fast break.
Fast break. Well, when is your fast then? Around now. That's why we timed it, so you can go and eat. There you go. So people in Israel, b'vakasheh, get coffee and pizza and sushi and chicken. I don't know. What do you eat to break your fast? Okay. Okay. Thank you, Atara. A pleasure. We look forward to having you again soon. Okay. And say hi to Tikva.
I will. I'll let her back in the apartment now.
Let her back in the apartment. Yes. Okay. Very good. And to Noah also. We'll bring her back to the apartment. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.